I am not a marriage guidance counsellor. I'm not any kind of counsellor, to be honest. I've not been trained. I have some life experience and I'm always ready to listen. But we advertised this evening as a What the Bible Says, so I do know a bit about theology. And so we're going to start with a Bible study. And if that sounds desperately boring, I'll try and make it interesting. And we may expand on things later and we're open to questions at the end. So, if I said to you, what does the Bible say about divorce and remarriage? What do you think it says? Bit is probably Matthew 19, which, as you say, is more or less repeated in Mark. So let's just read through that and see what it actually says. Some Pharisees came to him to test him. They asked, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? Haven't you read, he replied, that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female and said, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife and the two will become one flesh. So there are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate. Why then, they asked, did Moses command that a man give his wife a certificate of divorce and send her away? Jesus replied, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard, but it was not this way from the beginning. I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another woman commits adultery. So the first thing I'm seeing there is that there is possibly one valid reason for divorce, and if you are divorced for that reason, you are allowed to remarry. But what is that reason? I mean, I'm terrible at things like this. It bothers me. So, sexual immorality, what does that mean? If I come home and find Nikki watching a DVD of the Full Monty, is that sexual immorality? Can I divorce her? Probably not. But what does it mean? Sexual immorality. If we don't understand what a Bible passage means, where do we go? Well, one thing we do is context. And the immediate context is you read the verses before it and the verses after it. In this case, that isn't going to help because this passage is not connected with what comes before it and what comes after it. Another thing we can do is look at different Bible translations, because we all know Jesus spoke in Aramaic. It was written down in Greek and it has been translated into English. And different translators translate things differently. So often if you look at other versions of the Bible, it can help your understanding. If we look at that word translated in different versions, it becomes really interesting. I'll guess I'm using NIV unless. So some Bibles, King James, Wycliffe Bible, American Standard, say fornication. The Message says adultery, which is what it's normally taken as, but actually it's in the minority of the Bibles that say it. Sexual immorality, the NIV and the New King James. Unchastity, the RSV and the Amplified Bible. Sexual unfaithfulness, the Common English Bible. Unfaithfulness, Good News and J.B. Phillips. And this is my favourite. Whoredom, Young's Literal Translation. Now, like me, you probably realise those words don't all mean the same thing. Unchastity means you marry a girl, and when you marry her, you find she's not a virgin. That's unchastity. That is a grounds for divorce. Fornication means having sex when you're not married, so a married woman cannot commit fornication, so that seems ludicrous. Unless it means fornication before marriage, in which case it becomes the same as unchastity. Adultery, you marry someone and after you've married them, they have sex with someone else. Sexual unfaithfulness, sexual immorality are kind of broad terms. And I'm not even going to attempt the last one. So, I'm left with a problem. I don't really know what this one ground, or does it mean any of those grounds, is. If I'm really clever, I can go to the Greek. And so, never mind the translators, I'll see what the Greek says. If you go to the Greek, that's the word that's used, porneia, from which we get pornography and pornographic. And literally, it translates as sexual immorality. which is fine, but what did the Greeks consider sexual immorality? Because in ancient Greece, it was considered quite normal for a married man to have sex with a young boy. It was considered porneia to have sex with another man, quite the reverse of what society considers normal nowadays. So that isn't really helping either. It just means sexual immorality. Now, my problem gets even worse when I look at Paul's writing, 1 Corinthians 7, because I have few heroes in life, but one of them is Paul. And Paul gives some teaching which, on the face of it, looks completely different to the teaching that Jesus has just given. So to the rest I say this, I, not the Lord. If any brother has a wife who is not a believer and she's willing to live with him, he must not divorce her. And if a woman has a husband who is not a believer and he is willing to live with her, she must not divorce him. This is because the Corinthians had written to him and said, you know, some of our members have become Christians and living with a non-Christian husband and considering the kind of sexual immorality that went on in the Roman Empire and in places like Corinth, that was going to be an impediment to living a Christian life. And so they divorced their husbands and wives so they could live a more Christian life. And Paul is just saying here, no, that's wrong thinking. You should stay with them. Going on to verse 15. But if the unbeliever leaves, let it be so. Now that doesn't mean much to us, but to the Corinthians that meant everything. The Corinth is a city at a crossroads. So if you can think of a map of Greece, you've got northern Greece, then it goes to a very thin point, and then out again to southern Greece. And so any shipping traffic going east to west or west to east, rather than sail all the way around the bottom of Greece, particularly in winter when you had storms, used to go across this narrow strip of land, and they'd put in a rolling road of logs so they could drag boats across from one side to the other. And of course all the road traffic going north to south or south to north went through this narrow gap as well. And so you naturally built a city there where trade routes crossed and you had lots of merchants. So it was a Greek city, but it was under Roman rule and Roman law. Greek divorce laws said all you had to do was write a certificate of divorce, give it to your other half, and you were divorced. You didn't have to have a reason. Roman divorce law was even more lax. You didn't even need a bit of paper. All you had to do was say, I've had enough, I'm going, and you were both legally divorced and both legally entitled to get married again. And so when Paul writes the Corinthians and says, if the other half leaves, they know he means they're walking out on the marriage. And he says at that point, the brother or sister is not bound in such circumstances. That means they're not bound to their marriage. They're then free to get married again. So Paul's teaching here seems to be, if an unbelieving husband or wife divorces you, let them do it and you're free to get married again. And that on the face of it sounds absolutely different to what Jesus seems to be teaching in Matthew 19. We have a problem to solve here. Another way of understanding the Bible is in context. We always look at the New Testament in the context of the Old. I say it's like painting a picture. The Old Testament is the background. The New Testament are the characters in the foreground. And to make sense of what the characters in the foreground are doing, you really need the background. Is it a war? Is it in a living room? Is it on a farm? What's the background? So we always try and understand the New Testament in the light of the Old. And we're given a massive clue here that we ought to do that, because it says, Moses commanded that a man give his wife a certificate of divorce. So we might think we ought to find something in the law of Moses about divorce and divorce certificates. And in the whole of the Mosaic law, there's only one place that it mentions a divorce certificate. That's Deuteronomy 24, starting at verse 1. When a man takes a wife and marries her, then she finds no favour in his eyes, because he has found a cause of sexual immorality in her, he writes her a certificate of divorce, gives it to her, and sends her from his house. So, again it's saying a cause of sexual immorality. Now my Greek is minimal, my Hebrew is non-existent. Apparently the Hebrew word is again a bit of a loose word that could mean several things. it is generally taken to be adultery. There is a problem with that. Two chapters earlier in Deuteronomy, it says anyone caught in adultery must be stoned to death. Well, actually it says put to death. It doesn't specify the means. But dead people don't need a certificate of divorce. So let's take it means adultery for now. And there is one other place in the Mosaic Law that talks about divorce, but doesn't use the word divorce and doesn't mention a certificate. That's in Exodus 21, verse 7. And this is a kind of particular strange situation, if you want. If a man sells his daughter as a servant, she is not to go free as male servants do. If she does not please the master who has selected her for himself, he must let her be redeemed. Now that's talking about someone buying a wife or buying a slave as a wife. And then in verse 10 it says, if he marries another woman, and at this point polygamy was allowed in Jewish society, in fact it was still allowed after the time of Jesus, so he takes a second wife, he must not deprive the first one of her food, clothing and marital rights. That's a polite way of saying sex, if you haven't spotted. If he does not provide her with these three things, she is to go free without any payment of money. So she's bought as a slave, but if he doesn't look after her when he's taking a second wife, she can walk out as a free person, not as a slave. So that was the law of Moses on that one. Let me pass on. I'm going to do a quick history lesson through the Old Testament now. Quick timeline. So the law of Moses, about 1300 BC. First king of Israel was Saul in about 1050, 250 years later. You'd think at that stage they'd still be sticking to the law of Moses, but they weren't. They were no longer celebrating the Passover at that point. You'd think that's a fairly important part of the law. You must keep the Passover every year. They'd stop doing it by the time of Saul. It says in 2 Kings 23, and this is one of the later kings, celebrate the Passover to the Lord your God as it is written in the book of the covenant. Neither in the days of the judges who led Israel, nor in the days of the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah, had any such Passover been observed. I'm not sure how much of the rest of the law they'd also abandoned. Now, after Saul, the next king is David, who's always seen as the best king. He's seen as the best king largely because he was always faithful to God. Okay, he had adultery, he murdered her husband. He wasn't great, but at least he never went after other gods. The rot set in when we get to Solomon. So David's son Solomon comes along, 600 wives, 300 concubines, that's a recipe for disaster. 600 mother-in-laws, as someone said. And these foreign wives came with their foreign gods, and he tolerated it. He's said to be the wisest man ever, but I do wonder at times. He built the temple. David wasn't allowed to build the temple. Solomon was. And this is the conversation Solomon has with God when he's finished the temple. Starting 2 Chronicles 7, verse 17. As for you, if you walk before me faithfully, as David your father did, and do all I command, and observe my decrees and laws, I will establish your royal throne as I covenanted with David your father, when I said, you shall never fail to have a successor to rule over Israel. But if you turn away and forsake the decrees and commands I have given you, and go off to serve other gods and worship them, then I will uproot Israel from my land which I have given them, and I will reject this temple I have consecrated for my name. I will make it a byword and an object of ridicule among all people. This temple will become a heap of rubble. All who pass by will be appalled and say, why has the Lord done such a thing to this land and to this temple? And people will answer, because they have forsaken the Lord, the God of their ancestors, who brought them out of Egypt, and have embraced other gods and worshipped and serving them. That is why he brought about all this disaster. So, God has warned Solomon very, very clearly. You go after other gods and you're heading for trouble. But then he starts building temples and altars for foreign gods just outside the walls of Jerusalem. You can't believe it. 2 Kings 23, it says this. The king also, this is talking about a much later king and what he did. The king also desecrated the high places that were east of Jerusalem on the south of the Hill of Corruption, the one Solomon, king of Israel, had built for Ashtoreth, the vile goddess of the Sidonians, for Chemosh, the vile god of Moab, and for Molech, the detestable god of the people of Ammon. So he built these altars just outside Jerusalem. Unsurprisingly, when Solomon died, the kingdom split. There was the tribe of Judah and a few others who took the southern kingdom with Jerusalem. And then the other 10 and a half tribes set up a separate kingdom, the kingdom of Israel, in the north. The northern kingdom set up its capital at Samaria. Israel was exiled in 722. Let's just draw a little diagram here. The Old Testament talks about the relationship between God and Israel as a marriage. God as the husband, Israel as the wife, right? And very much as in the New Testament, it talks about the church being the bride of Christ. Christ is the husband, the church is the bride. Now, if we have a normal marriage, what constitutes adultery? It's when the woman goes with another man. Or the man goes with another woman. Yeah. All right, sorry, I'm not trying to be sexist here, but whichever way around, when they're unfaithful. So in terms of this marriage relationship, what constitutes adultery is when Israel goes after another god. And we see that Israel time and again is going after other gods. And the Bible actually calls that spiritual adultery. It talks in those terms. Eventually, it gets too much. And God effectively divorces Israel in 772 BC. And that is the language that is used. Jeremiah 3 verse 8. I gave faithless Israel her certificate of divorce and sent her away because of all her adulteries. Yet I saw that her unfaithful sister Judah had no fear. She also went out and committed adultery. So God divorced. Anyone who's divorced and think God does not understand, he does, because he went through it himself. God divorced his bride, and that's the language that is used in the Bible. It's not used of Judah. In Judah is seen as a separation with an eventual reconciliation, but the language is used that he divorced Israel. Judah didn't learn. Judah carried on serving other gods. How bad did it get before God decided he had enough of Judah? You wouldn't believe it. 2 Kings 21. Manasseh, one of the last kings of Judah, was 12 years old when he became king. Verse 3. He rebuilt the high places his father Hezekiah had destroyed. Hezekiah was one of the few good kings who took down all the foreign temples, but his son built them up again. He also erected altars to Baal and made an Asherah pole, as Ahab, king of Israel, had done. He bowed down to all the starry hosts and worshipped them. He built altars in the temple of the Lord, of which the Lord had said, in Jerusalem I will put my name. In the two courts of the temple of the Lord he built altars to all the starry hosts. He sacrificed his own son in the fire, practiced divination, sought omens, and consulted mediums and spiritists. He did much evil in the eyes of the Lord, arousing his anger. He took the carved Asherah pole he had made and put it in the temple. You couldn't believe it, could you? He's here building temples and sacrificial altars to other gods inside the temple courts in Jerusalem. I've put it in human terms. It's as if a wife was having sex with another man in her own bedroom with her husband watching. And God said, that's it, I've had enough. So he walks away from Judah as well. And Judah goes into exile. 587 BC. Malachi 2:15. interesting verse as well. God speaking, I hate divorce, says the Lord God of Israel. I hate it when one of you does such a cruel thing to his wife. Now, in context, he's talking to the priests who were in exile in Babylon, who weren't treating their wives particularly well. But some people have said, you know, here God is saying, I hate divorce, because he knows what he's talking about. He's been through it. I've been divorced, I hate it. It's horrible for everyone involved. But there's reconciliation. 50 years after the exile, they return from exile. And then they go back to God in a big way. They go back to the law. So Nehemiah verse 8, starting at verse 1, this is when the people have returned to Jerusalem and they get out the old books of the law. All the people came together as one in the square before the water gate. They told Ezra, the teacher of the law, to bring out the book of the law of Moses, which the Lord had commanded for Israel. So on the first day of the seventh month, the priest brought out the law before the assembly, which was made up of men and women and all who were able to understand. He read it aloud from daybreak till noon as he faced the square before the water gate in the presence of the men, women and others who could understand. And all the people listened attentively to the book of the law. All the people had been weeping as they listened to the words of the law. Day after day, from the first day to the last, Ezra read from the book of the law of God. They celebrated the festival for 7 days. Can you imagine? They were standing all day for 7 days, wanting to hear the law of Moses. There had been a complete change in this restoration. They had repented of their chasing after other gods. And for the next 500 years, we have what is called the rabbinic period of Judaism, because it was run, the country was run by the rabbis and the Pharisees and the scribes, who basically taught the law and held court and judgment on the law. And they dissected the law down to the smallest detail. So if we go back and look at this particular bit of law we saw earlier, Exodus 21, starting verse 10. If he marries another woman, he must not deprive the first one of her food, clothing, and marital rights. If he does not provide her with these three things, she is to go free without any payment of money. Now, this is what is known as case law. The statute law, which is the written down law, and case law is what happens in a court, because you have to interpret it. You can't cater for every specific case or every different case in statute law. So you have things called case law. Once a judge has decided on one case, that is seen to have set a precedent for other things that follow. And so it isn't about the detail, it's more about the principle that is involved. And so the Pharisees looked at this, the rabbis, and they said, well, okay, this is about a slave girl who has been bought as a wife. But if it applies to a slave girl that's been bought as a wife, surely it should apply equally to a free person who's married and then he takes a second wife. So they said it applies to any woman. And then they said, well, actually, if it applies to a woman, surely it must apply equally to a man. And so if the woman deprives the husband of food and clothing and marital rights, surely he should have the right to divorce her. And so, by the time of Jesus, it was set in the law effectively, there were four reasons for divorce. A man or a woman could divorce his other half for lack of provision of food, clothing, or marital rights. And a husband could divorce his wife for adultery. That was a one way. The wife could not divorce the husband for adultery. We would see it differently nowadays, but that was the law at the time. And of course, the scribes and the Pharisees set everything down in great detail. They specified exactly how many hours a week a woman was to spend sewing and just how much food she needed to supply. And I started on Sunday by teasing you and saying, well, they also specified how often a man was supposed to be available for sex with his wife. Do you want the answer? The answer's even better than the question. If you were a donkey driver, you were expected to satisfy your wife once a week. Why if you're a donkey driver. Well, donkey drivers are the equivalent of long-distance lorry drivers. They could be away for 3 or 4 nights a week, so it seemed only appropriate that they only had to pleasure their wife once a week. If you're a normal person, like a shopkeeper or a farmer or a mason or a carpenter, you had to be available twice a week. They had all this in a table. You know, there wasn't a simple answer. If you're unemployed, now, I secretly think this was a kind of first century BC government-sponsored back-to-work initiative. Don't quote me on that one. Let's finish our timeline. 332 BC, Alexander the Great rides into Jerusalem in triumph. He was welcomed in by the Jews. They saw him as fulfillment of an ancient prophecy. 37 BC, the Romans took over. They weren't welcomed into Jerusalem. They were hated. And then, not BC, Jesus is born. Right, we've painted the background. Look at the teaching of Jesus. Now, I don't know if you realise, but the teaching of Jesus in the Gospels is not comprehensive. He doesn't teach about everything, not even everything important. So, for instance, circumcision. There's no teaching on circumcision in the Gospels. Not that it wasn't important. Every young boy was circumcised. Jesus was circumcised. Why is there no teaching on it? Because it wasn't controversial. No one disagreed with it. You'll find the teaching of Jesus in the Gospels is either where he is saying something that is quite countercultural or different to what most people believe, or where he's being asked the political question of the day. So people came to him and tested him as a rabbi. What do you think about this hot potato that everybody else is arguing about? So, for instance, Sadducees and the Pharisees, when the Sadducees came up to him and talked this about a woman who was married to 7 brothers, because if your husband died without children, your brother was supposed to marry the widow and give her children, which would inherit the dead brother's name, to continue the name. And so they had this trumped up story about a wife and 7 brothers, all of whom died in turn. And that was because the Sadducees did not believe in life after death. That's why they were sad, you see. The old ones are always the best. The Pharisees did believe in life after death, and so the Sadducees had thought up this convoluted story to show why life after death was ridiculous, because whose wife was she going to be when they were all raised from the dead? And Jesus, of course, said, well, there is no marriage in heaven. Pay taxes to Caesar. The Jews hated the Romans. They hated paying taxes to Caesar. They were looking for a rabbi who was going to say, well, you need to pay the temple tax, but if you can cheat on the tax for Rome, then, you know, good luck to you. It was a trick question. There was no good answer. If he said you should pay taxes to Caesar, then all the Jews are going to think, well, we don't like you. And if he said you don't pay taxes to Caesar, then the Romans would arrest him. So, you know, trick question. He said, show me a coin. And he said, whose head is this on it? They said, Caesar's. And he said, well, give to Caesar what's Caesar's and give to God what's God's. The woman caught in adultery, John 8:3. This is a really strange story for many reasons. First of all, why did they just drag the woman to him? Because the Mosaic law said that they should both be put to death if you catch a couple committing adultery, not just the woman. The Mosaic law also said that you can't accuse someone of a crime you've committed yourself, which is why Jesus said to them, he who hasn't got any sin, throw the first stone. And they all realised, well, actually, I can't pronounce a guilty, and wandered off one at a time. But again, it was kind of a political Roman story as well, because under Roman rule, only a Roman could pronounce a death sentence. So the Mosaic law said she should be put to death. If Jesus says put her to death, he's in trouble with the Romans. If he says don't put her to death, he's in trouble with the Jews, because he isn't upholding the Mosaic law. So either way, he's stuck. And so divorce in Matthew 19 is not a simple question. It's a trick question. It's a political hot potato that he's being asked about. If he was to be asked, is it okay for a man to divorce his wife? He would have said, yes, for four reasons. Lack of clothing, lack of food, lack of marital affection, or adultery. Because that was the answer to the simple question, is divorce allowed? They didn't ask him a simple question. Now, to understand the question they asked him, we need to go back and look at Deuteronomy again. So here we are. When a man takes a wife and marries her, then she finds no favour in his eyes because he has found a cause of sexual immorality in her, he writes her a certificate of divorce. We know this is the question they were asking him about because they specifically talked about Moses writing a certificate of divorce. But I said the place was ruled by the rabbis and that they were dissecting the law to the lowest level. One rabbi looked at this and said, why does it say he has found a cause of sexual immorality? Why doesn't it just say for sexual immorality? Why has it got the words a cause in there? Surely they are redundant. But this was the law given by God to Moses, so the words can't be redundant. They must be in there for a purpose. And what he concluded was this. He concluded that this is actually two grounds for divorce. You can either divorce your wife for sexual immorality, or you can divorce your wife for a cause. Now, the obvious question is, what cause? Well, it doesn't say what cause, so it must be any cause whatsoever. And so he invented the no-fault divorce. He said, you are allowed to divorce your wife for any reason whatsoever. And so the divorce certificate didn't even have a reason on it because you didn't need one. You could just say, I divorce you. It was effectively the Greek divorce law. You just give your wife a certificate of divorce that says, I'm divorcing you for a reason. And that was the teaching of one set of rabbis. And it became very popular because it was nice and easy and you didn't have to prove anything. You didn't have to go to court. You could just give a certificate of divorce and you were divorced. Now, some other rabbis, of course, said, that's ridiculous. It just means sexual immorality. I know it says a cause of sexual immorality just means sexual immorality. So there was this big debate going on between one set of rabbis that said, you can divorce your wife for any reason, and another set who said, no, you can only divorce her for adultery. And so they went to Jesus as a rabbi and said, which side do you take in this debate? If we look at Matthew 19 again, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? It doesn't say, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? It says for any and every reason. And that was, if you go back to the Greek, it was a technical legal term that appeared on the divorce certificates, on the no-fault divorce certificates. So they were specifically asking him, what do you think about no-fault divorce? And I like his answer. He does a Margaret Thatcher. I don't know whether you remember Margaret Thatcher when she was interviewed, and the interviewer would say, well, Margaret, I need to ask you about X, Y, Z. And she would patronisingly put her hand on his knee and go, no, I think you really want to ask me about ABC. And the answer to ABC is, and I used to sit there screaming at the TV, no, we want to know about X, Y, Z. He asked you about it. And she used to get away with it. She'd invent her own question and answer it. And that's what Jesus does here. He ignores the question and he says, I don't want to talk about something negative like divorce. I want to talk about marriage. I want to talk about the positives. I want to talk about the good things in a marriage. And then in verse 7, they're not letting him get away with it. They drag him back to the question. Why then, they ask, did Moses command that a man give his wife a certificate of divorce? And Jesus replied, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard. So he's saying, if there's stubborn and unrepentant sin, you are allowed to divorce. Not you have to divorce, but you are allowed. You have the choice as the innocent party. If your spouse is committing adultery, you don't have to divorce them. It's your choice. And Jesus would say, try for reconciliation. Try to make it work. But if there's stubborn, persistent sin, you have the right to divorce. But anyone who divorces his wife except for adultery, so in other words, anyone who takes a no-fault divorce because your wife burnt the dinner or because her younger sister's looking more attractive, that is not a valid divorce. And if you're not divorced, then if you marry someone else, you're committing adultery. So he's answering a specific question here. That's why there is no clash between what Jesus is teaching and what Paul is teaching. Paul is effectively upholding the lack of food, clothing and marital rights. Because if someone walks out on the marriage, they are clearly no longer providing either food or clothing or physical affection. And so Paul is effectively upholding the Exodus 21 reason for divorce. And Jesus is here commenting on the Deuteronomy 24 reason for divorce. Summary. Should we then think that divorce is allowed? Yes. Is divorce allowed for any reason? Well, no. I think Jesus was quite clear on that. Is remarriage allowed after divorce? The whole purpose of divorce is to allow remarriage. Divorce does not end a marriage. Divorce is the legal stamp being put on a marriage that has already ended. So it is just the legal acknowledgement that a marriage has already ended. And what ends a marriage? Persistent sin on behalf of one party. The Moses divorce law was quite forward-looking at the time. It wasn't the only one in the ancient world. In the Babylonian Empire, they had divorce laws. So you've got a problem. Your husband's a soldier, he goes off to fight a battle, and he doesn't come back. You're left with two children and three fields. What do? Well, you really need a man in your life. You assume your husband has died in the battle, and so you marry someone else who looks after you and looks after your children and gets your crops growing. 3 years later, the husband comes back and says, "What are you doing here? This is my wife and my fields and my kids. You clear off." And he had the legal right to reclaim his wife because it was his wife. Now, the upshot of that was that if someone didn't come back from a battle, no one was going to marry his widow because, you know, I'm not going to put 3 years into this family just to be told to clear off because he's decided to do a grand tour of the Middle East. I always wondered what Damascus looked like, you know. And so they invented a kind of divorce law which said if your husband hasn't returned within 2 years, you can apply to the government and get a certificate of divorce which says you are now free to marry someone else. And if your husband comes back more than 2 years late, tough luck on him. And so it was the same with Moses. The divorce certificate said no one else has a claim on this person and they are free to marry whoever they want. Every archaeological dig that has found a divorce certificate from pre-Jesus through and afterwards has written at the bottom, you are now free to remarry. So the purpose of a divorce certificate is to prove that there is no incumbencies and you are free to remarry. So is remarriage allowed after divorce? Yes. For a Christian, marriage is only allowed to another Christian. 1 Corinthians 7, Paul says that. You're free to get remarried, but only in the Lord. I think that's the phrase that Paul uses. So Christians are only expected to marry other Christians, whether for the first or the second time. Nikki hates this talk because I'm dealing with legalism, I'm dealing with the law, and we're not under law, we're under grace. She thinks it's too sharp, it has too many edges on it, it's too legalistic. She would rather say, we're all sinners, we're all in need of forgiveness. Amen. And we should treat each other in that way. And I think she's right. You know, when you start trying to prove fault in a divorce, it's something you probably don't want to get into. I mean, to illustrate how difficult it could be, well, I've got a kind of unreal case that I've dreamt up. So you talk to the lady and she says, I want to get remarried. I've divorced my husband. He was having an affair with this secretary at work. Well, that's clear cut. He's a cad and a bounder. It's his fault. my sympathiometer goes right over to the lady and says, yeah, you're quite right. And then you bump into him and he tells a quite different story. He said, yeah. He said, I'm really sorry about that. He said, but, you know, my wife had refused to have sex with me for 2 years. And I was just at, you know, a work's due. We were celebrating this big sale that went through, and I probably had one too many, and the secretary came on to me, and one thing led to another. And, you know, I really regretted it the next morning, and I went and apologised to my wife, but, you know, she didn't want to. My sympathyometer has now sung right over to him. Well, okay, if she didn't have sex with him, he had biblical grounds for divorce. To do it properly, he should have divorced her and then married his secretary before jumping into bed with her. But I still give him the sympathy vote at this stage. And then you go back to her and you say, well, your husband says that you refused to have sex with him for 2 years. And she said, well, last time I had sex with him, he put his hands on my throat and strangled me. I passed out. I thought I was going to die. It terrified me. He can be quite violent, and so I'm frightened to have sex with him again. Oh no, my swing sympathyometer has just swung back in her direction. And, you know, marriage breakups are never simple. Never make a judgment unless you've talked to both sides, and then it's better not to be judgmental, because we're all sinners, we all need forgiveness. Have we got any more final thoughts here? The Bible allows divorce for four reasons. It doesn't command divorce, it allows it. Divorce is always painful. It's painful for the couple, it's painful for friends and relatives, especially any children involved. And therefore, first resort should always be to try and heal the marriage rather than head for divorce. Divorce does not end a marriage. It is simply the legal recognition that a marriage has already ended. Persistent, unrepentant sin ends the marriage. Divorcees with a valid divorce are allowed, even expected, to remarry. However, attributing blame can be difficult or impossible. And as Christians, we're in the love, forgiveness, and restoration game. The only thing is, Jesus clearly condemned no-fault divorces.